This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
In today's fast-paced, tech-driven, distraction-filled world, it can be difficult to find moments of peace. So today on Raise Your Game, the show about personal and professional development, I'm Christine Wong, speaking to Sandy Clark and Eugene T all about their book, Mindfulness and Emotions, which discusses how we can practice mindfulness in our lives and why it's so important. And we do talk about kind of mindfulness and mindsets a lot on Raise Your Game, but, you know, it's always a topic that we can revisit because it's a fun time. So thank you very much for coming into the studio.
Thanks very much, Christine.
It's great to be here.
All right. So I think the best way to start this off is just to ask, you know, because mindfulness is a very, very popular buzzword. You know, we hear it a lot, but we don't necessarily know what it conveys. So what is the definition of mindfulness?
Well, that's quite an interesting question to start off with. And you always get a slightly different answer depending on who you ask. Mm. For us, that we define mindfulness as conscientious awareness, which each of us have a baseline awareness, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to get out of the bed in the morning without injuring yourself. So we kind of have some degree of awareness from our day-to-day activities. But for most of us, and the research shows that we can spend an awful lot of the time with our mind that's wandering into the past or into the future. Mm. So why it's important to cultivate awareness, and this is what mindfulness helps us to work towards, is because our ability to sort of wander off into the past or the future actually costs a lot of mental energy, mm-hmm. Leads to things like stress, anxiety, depression, feeling of being overwhelmed.
Right.
We're always rushing to get to the next thing or thinking about that thing that someone said to us, you know, 6 months ago that we still can't get over. So there's been several studies that have showed that when our mind wanders so much, it actually leads to a lot of unhappiness and unpleasant emotions. And so mindfulness works essentially to ground you in the present and to pay more attention to life.
Yeah. You know, I think in the book as well, you guys talk a little bit about what I kind of call screensaver mode, which I don't know if that makes sense, but mm-hmm. this sort of going through life without really paying attention or really being aware of how you're going through life. For example, when you're driving, you don't necessarily notice everything around you. And then you guys also mentioned a really interesting, I think this was an experiment where some scientists showed a video of people playing basketball, and then there was just like one dude in a gorilla suit in the middle of it all. But a lot of the participants in the study didn't notice that because they were told to, I believe, count something to do with basketball in the study, right?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that just goes to show how inattentive we can actually be. Mm. And what we've attempted to do in the book is to just highlight the fact that we oftentimes, throughout the course of our lives and pretty much a lot of hours in a day, that we are on autopilot. Mm. So I think that's a term that we use. And in relation to the research that you described, yes, it was indeed true. So just as a very quick recap of the experiment, there was several people right on a video. They were actually passing around a basketball, and mm-hmm. the participants in that study were actually asked to count the number of times the basketball was actually passed in between the individuals in that particular video. But the sort of kicker in that experiment is that a person, a Confederate, a man in a gorilla suit actually walked past, just paused for a while in the middle of the video and started thumping his chest like any gorilla would,
right,
and just walked away. Now, towards the end of the experiment, the participants were actually asked, all right, so how many times did the basketball get passed around? All right, fair enough. Most people give an answer which is pretty accurate, maybe one or two passes short. Mm. But a lot of them actually failed to notice that a man had actually come out in a gorilla suit and thumped his chest in daylight, broad daylight. So it just goes to show you how selectively inattentive and blind we can actually be. And if you just sort of like extend on this to the fact that we live our lives pretty much every day taking the same route to work, we don't really think consciously, we are not really attending to the present moment, even when we are brushing our teeth or tying our shoes. And that's the example Sandy likes to give very often. We're already thinking about what awaits us at work. We are not fully attending. We're not really mindful.
You know, I totally get that sort of selective inattentiveness, right? And I think that is something that I think that is something that is increasing, mm-hmm. you know, as time goes on as well. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing that I wanted to clear up about mindfulness really quickly is that I think that there are a lot of misconceptions about what it is. And I think some people see it as a very sort of wishy-washy concept, right? So what are the most common misconceptions about mindfulness and how can you like debunk them?
Well, I think the main misconception that does the rounds is that it's a Buddhist practice. So you need to be Buddhist to practice mindfulness. Although the modern day practice stems from guidance that you would find in Buddhist teachings, it's actually a secular practice. So you could be Buddhist, Christian, atheist, or agnostic. It's a bit like learning to exercise in a gym. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter who shows you; it's the same exercise. You get the same benefit.
Right.
So a lot of people have those kind of concerns that you have to buy into a particular ideology or dogma, which is not the case at all. Another common one is that mindfulness is all about letting go, which is a byproduct of extensive practice. But this notion that you can either clear your mind or let go of emotions is pretty impossible. You're not using mindfulness in that sense. You're using willpower to suppress, which is quite counterproductive, because it's sort of like when you try to suppress emotions or difficult feelings, it's a bit like sending them to the gym to work out. They come back even stronger.
Right.
So mindfulness is more about confronting what you're thinking, confronting your thoughts and feelings, and to process them in a healthy way that can then kind of alleviate any kind of stress buildup, anxiety buildup in that sense.
There's been this trend towards mindfulness, and I think we do cover some part of this in the book as well.
Yeah.
Another one which I could just add on would be that mindfulness is easy. So it's about letting go. You know what? It's easier said than done.
Yeah.
And I think it's true cultivating a sort of disciplined practice that you do get better. And it's not something which you can accomplish after just a series of, simple workshops or a course of a week. In fact, I think most changes will only take place after a minimum of about 8 weeks.
Yes.
And most, say, mindfulness-based stress reduction workshops and sort of programs tend to take that duration. Mm. But the sort of plus point that comes with such disciplined practice is that it also changes the wirings in your brain to be able to help you manage your emotions and also to see your thoughts a little bit more objectively, to place a little bit of a buffer. So maybe just as a quick recap to what Sandy has said, mindfulness does have a religious sort of tradition, but you do not need to be religious to subscribe to any religious traditions in order to benefit from it. It is indeed a secular practice. It is not just all about letting go. Right. It's not just about, so if someone comes up to you and says that, I can teach you how to be mindful. All you have to do is observe your emotions, let it go. All the thoughts that come to your mind, just let it go. Just let it pass. And they might even toss in, metaphors like the flow of the current in a river, stuff like that, which makes it sound very, very esoteric almost. It almost makes it sound really wow.
I think that is why a lot of people tend to shy away from kind of embracing it and stuff like that, because there are some people who kind of, they'll propagate these kind of misconceptions as well and be like, it's okay, it's all zen and go with the flow and whatnot. But really,
go with the flow.
Right? But we'll talk a little bit about the fact that it is a habit that you have to cultivate, right? It's not something that you can just switch on and off.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And you actually mentioned a little bit that about the brain rewiring and stuff, and there is some scientific context and research to back up the benefits of mindfulness, right?
Absolutely. So research into mindfulness and meditation more generally has actually really caught on, especially in the scientific literature in the West. And for pretty much the longest time, I think it's only been within the past 3 or 4 decades that research into meditation has actually caught on in the West. Prior to that, it's seen as some kind of airy-fairy spiritual sort of practice with really, it doesn't do anything. It's really something out of the interest of science. But it would take some notable individuals, one of them being Matthew Reichardt. And he's been dubbed the happiest man in the world.
Mm.
So he's actually a Tibetan monk. And what he's done is participate in research. And generally, just to keep things succinct, what they have found is that meditation, mindfulness meditation being one of them, does change the structure of the brain. Individuals who are long-term meditators do display changes in parts of their brain associated with impulse control. They're also better to regulate difficult emotions. And parts of the brain which are associated with very social type emotions like empathy or emotion related processes like empathy, pro-social orientations, altruism, those actually benefit from having a long-term practice into meditation and of the practice of mindfulness as well.
Right. I mean, you mentioned, the fact that it helps to deal with emotions, right, as well. And that is something that you talk about in the book as well, where there's this very common idea that the mind, you can either be logical or emotional, right? But it's a lot more nuanced than that, of course, because, people are nuanced, right? So, what is that relationship between mindfulness and emotion?
I think to use a prime example of this idea of you're either logical or emotional, whenever Albert Einstein used to wrestle with a complex problem, He would often play the violin to engage his more creative, emotional side to help out with a logical problem. So there's this long debunked theory that we're either left-sided or right-sided mm-hmm. when it comes to our brain. Mm. But the whole system works as one. Each side of the brain does have responsibility for some basic functions. But when it comes to things like emotion, logic, characteristics or traits, they each kind of combine to navigate life in a sense. So mindfulness kind of, in terms of restructuring the brain, in terms of developing our emotional and our rational capabilities, meditation and mindfulness has been shown actually to bring these areas of the brain closer together, mm-hmm. you know, okay. in terms of the neural pathways and neural connections, to strengthen these, to actually kind of make things like emotional awareness and ability to, how would you say, reason and
yes.
rationalize.
Absolutely.
So that there's been a number of studies to show that, you know, this has been done.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. So I guess reason and emotion are a lot more interconnected than we might think at first. But it is time for a little bit of a break for some music. But after that, I'll continue speaking to Sandy Clark and Eugene T all about mindfulness and emotions, their book. So do stay tuned to Raise Your Game on Enterprise on BFM 89.9.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9, the business station.
You are listening to Raise Your Game. This is a show all about personal and professional development. I'm Christine Wong, and today I'm speaking to Sandy Clark and Eugene T all about their book, Mindfulness and Emotions. Now, before the break, we talked about how mindfulness is a very popular buzzword and kind of the definition of it and kind of some of the misconceptions that we debunked about what mindfulness is. But from that, you know, I want to focus a little bit more on the content that your book has itself, because there are some very interesting chapters that I think you guys go into a lot more detail about. So one of your chapters simply asks a very simple question, right? How free is the mind? Like, why is that an important question to ask in terms of mindfulness?
I think because a lot of people get the feeling that, you know, no matter what you do, no matter how much you practice in a certain way, you're going to behave in a certain manner anyway.
Right.
Right. So say, for example, if you have a very tough upbringing, if you live in impoverished conditions, then people would say, well, you know, something like mindfulness is not going to help because you're raised in such an environment that it's going to make you very difficult to be pro-social, etc.
Right.
But the research into free will has shown that actually before any kind of impulse to act comes up, we have a small window where we can essentially veto the action or decide to move forward. I do it all the time when I see the dessert tray and I think maybe I want the second piece of cake. Should I not? Mm. So that small second where you wrestle with yourself is the window where you can choose to either act or not act. And so some studies have shown that meditation can actually increase that length of the window. So it can give you more time to respond rather than react. Mm. So if there's something that, you need to react to quickly, but maybe you make the wrong choice, then meditation mindfulness tends to help you to consider your actions before you're able to then choose, you know, much more wisely what to do.
Right.
And so with free will, it's quite interesting. And the way I would use as an analogy is like if you're driving, right? So the road underneath your car and the road just in front of you, there's nothing you can do about that. So your immediate actions, your immediate responses, there's probably very little you can do in the moment to change what you're going to do, your hand gestures, your eye movements, etc. But if you look further along into the road in front of you, you can decide, okay, I'm going to go this way or that way. So if you're a bit more attentive, if you're a bit more aware, then you'll be able to sort of navigate the road in front of you a lot better. You can avoid hazards, etc. Whereas people who are maybe listening to music or talking to someone in the back of the car, for example, their attention might be less and it might lead them into an accident in that sense. So mindfulness kind of crosses over into everyday behaviors in the sense that you can become more considered and more, how would you say, careful about your actions, your speech and your behaviors.
Certainly right. A little more deliberate as well. And maybe just for the benefit of the listeners as well, mindfulness is essential in an attention-starved environment. I mean, pretty much everything's pulling us in many different directions. And just to maybe just align this example I'm going to give, based on what Sandy has described in his driving analogy, I think over the course of our days, we are inundated. We are swamped with messages from our tech devices, from our emails, from our WhatsApp message tones, from pretty much every single thing that is wired up and connected. Mm. So we are living in an age where attention is a scarce resource. Mm. And I think it might just provoke a little bit of thought to say that the one resource that we have the least of these days is our attention, because there's so many things that are pulling us in many different directions. Right. I'm sure readers will be able to relate when we're driving or when we're working and the message tone goes off and we have this sudden sort of impulse to just go and reach out and check it almost automatically. So what mindfulness can do, if we just use that example along with Sandy's driving example, is that there is that window, there is that buffer, there is that short span of time in which you can veto and be a little bit more deliberate, a little bit more conscious about what you choose to do. So I think that's a benefit of practicing mindfulness for those of us who are actually working 9-to-5 jobs in offices.
Right. And, you know, I think that's a great segue actually into my next question, because you say practicing mindfulness, right? And it's not, again, like we talked about it before the break, it's not a switch you can turn on and off. Mm-hmm. It's not a behavior that you can just immediately be like, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm mindful now. I'm good, right? Yeah. Like, you can't do that. It is actually a habit, right? It's something that you have to develop. So, mm-hmm. you know, talk to me a little bit about that. Like, how do you go about starting to develop mindfulness as a habit?
You can start off with little things throughout your day. So for example, if you're someone who rushes around before you go to work in the morning, you could ask yourself, for example, if you're in the shower. Now, there's very little you can do about your work while in the shower. You can't answer your emails, you can't go to meetings, you can't worry about the traffic jam that's maybe going to come up. Mm. So to take that time just to say to yourself, okay, for the next 5-10 minutes, I'm just going to be in this experience and just enjoy it, you know, and just be present to this experience. And it sounds so simple, but it has such an immense effect on the mind, because what it does is it slows down that tendency to jump after the next thing, because we're always kind of, as I said earlier, jumping into the future or back to the past. And so the present moment often gets squeezed out. So mindfulness, although there's several techniques you can use to become mindful, it's not the activity that matters, it's the attending. Right. So anything that you can pay attention to. Another thing that I am quite fond of using in workshops, etc., is that when you brush your teeth in the morning, chances are you always start from the same side. So a challenge could be the next morning, try to brush your teeth from a different area, starting off. Say you brush from the top left, try the bottom right. And you'll be amazed at how difficult that is. And it just goes to show, coming back to what Eugene said earlier on, how inattentive we can be. Even the shoes, if you put on your shoes, generally speaking, you put your right or left one on first, try and switch it up. And so just these little amendments in your activities to pay more attention. When you're conversing with someone, put the phone away. Mm. Engage in the conversation, be with that person. Don't try and think about the meeting you have afterwards, or the dinner you have to prepare, or the thing you have to do next week. Trying to just focus on whatever you're doing at a single time. Now, there's a question that comes up to say that, well, if we're always in the present, surely that means that we can't plan for the future. But it's not that we shouldn't plan for the future or even think about the past. It's when we get caught up excessively, caught up with the past and the future, that it becomes problematic.
I'd just like to say a really quick thing. I wonder how many people suddenly violently realize which side of their mouth they brush. Because the moment you said that, I was like, oh gosh, I actually do always start at the same point in my teeth every single time.
Yeah, me too.
So I'm going to try that. I'm going to try that when I get back home today and be like, you know what, let's shake it up. So that's really interesting as well. And I think that's a really interesting point. There are so many things that we do in our lives that we just don't really pay attention to. Mm. And it's not that we have to necessarily. Obviously, things like brushing your teeth, you don't have to be consciously aware of brushing your teeth every single day. Mm. But it's really about just picking a moment to focus entirely on, I suppose. Mm-hmm. So for me, the first thing that came to mind was I do put aside a specific time in the morning to do my makeup every day. But that's all I do. Mm-hmm. And that's all I focus on. And I don't think about anything else. I don't think about work. I don't think about calls. I don't think about anything. Mm-hmm. I just sit there. I put on eyeliner. It's very relaxing, right?
There we go.
But that's in a way, you know, I guess you could say that's me taking that moment to be consciously aware of what I'm doing and to be absolutely in that present moment as well, right? So it can be anything, but, you know, it's always fun to just have a moment like that.
And I think you pick on a good point there, that when you're in the moment, when you're doing something, it is quite enjoyable. It's quite relaxing.
Yeah.
And yet when we're mindless, when our minds are all over the place, that's when we become fatigued and stressed out and tired. So it's interesting to note that difference when we are a bit more mindful.
Absolutely. You know, kind of coming off of that, right? Could you guys both share maybe some examples of how you use mindfulness in your day-to-day? I mean, apart from the brushing teeth situation.
I like to use this example, and I think it's fairly relatable as well, because we love to eat.
Yes.
And we have a very intimate, special relationship with our food, where we're actually very defensive about our food as well.
Yeah.
Right? So we sometimes, Sandy and I run workshops where we get people to practice something called mindful eating. And many a times over the course of our day, now 9 to 5, we're very busy. We just wolf down our lunch.
Mm.
I think you like to use the term, we put it into our mouths like a cement mixer, actually would. So that's a rather unsavory, a rather like unflattering depiction. But right. In fact, that's true. I mean, many a times we rush through our meals. We don't really enjoy it. Part of our attention is still glued onto the screen, onto our phones. And lunch is just seen to be something that we need to get over and done with so that we can resume what it is that is required of us. Now, contrast that with, say, a meal that you enjoy with family, a meal which, you know, you have over the weekend, and you're just there attending to the tastes, the interactions, the laughter, the atmosphere, the ambience of the restaurant. These are things that you don't pick up when you're mindlessly attending to other things, right? So just in relation to that, I think we can tie in the practice of mindfulness with another practice, and positive psychologists call this savoring. So they are, you're attending fully to that moment. You're also taking in and enjoying the pleasant emotions that follows from that. So mindful eating would be a very simple one. Just as a couple of simple tips, what you could do is, we like to use chocolate, I think. It's the best, yeah. Isn't it? So
this is the best raise your game advice. Right. Just eat chocolate.
Savor chocolate. Eat chocolate mindfully. So rather than, you know, gulp the whole thing down, just before that, observe the chocolate. I think these also suggest principles of mindfulness. Being curious, being sort of like aware. I say, hey, this is a nice little piece of chocolate. It's got a different aroma. It's got different textures. Maybe if I observe it a little bit more closely, I pick up something about this chocolate that I've not had realized prior, and smell it, take a whiff of it. Then and only then do you lay it onto your tongue.
Mm-hmm.
Just let it just sort of melt slowly, take in the aromas. You know, just by me describing it, you feel hungry. It's just craving for chocolate. And then and only then do you really take in the flavors, the tones, the notes of the chocolate.
So really the lesson I'm taking from this is to attend more food tasting or drink tasting classes, really.
That might be useful, Sen.
Yeah, I mean, things like the two main activities I try is expressive writing, so keeping a journal, which can help you actually spend time with how you've been feeling throughout the day, you know, the interactions you've been having.
Right.
And again, it just allows you to process what you've been doing in that day and over a week, etc. And that has a number of benefits as well in terms of psychological health and well-being. And of course, meditation is the big one, which I try to do every day. And it's sort of like working out at a gym. If you do one meditation session, for example, you're not going to notice too much, but you will gain benefits nonetheless, you know. But if you keep it going maybe over 1 week, 2 weeks, then you'll start to see the benefits building up from there.
All right. Well, that about wraps up today's Raise Your Game. Thank you so much, Sandy and Eugene, for talking to me all about your book, Mindfulness and Emotions, today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, if you've missed any of this interview, you can obviously listen to it again or even download it if that really is up your alley. You can do that on our app on the Apple App Store and Google Play. You can also head over to our website, bfm.my/podcast as well. You can also head over to Spotify because we're on there now too. We are under the podcast option. You have been listening to Raise Your Game on BFM 89.9. Stay tuned.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.